fall of the China virus is that China's actions gave a month of breathing space to other countries, which they did not take advantage of.
We will come to the East v West comparison a little bit later on in the programme. The city of Kenosha, Wisconsin, and its population of just over 100,000 have been under the spotlight of American national politics ever since the shooting of a black man, Jacob Blake, by a white police officer last month. The shooting led to protests and gave fresh momentum to the calls for racial justice that began in the summer after the killing of another black man, George Floyd, in Minnesota. In Wisconsin, some of these protests turned violent, prompting criticism from President Trump.
Violent mobs demolished or damaged at least 25 businesses, burned down public buildings, and threw bricks at police officers, which your police officers won't stand for, and they didn't stand for it. These are not acts of peaceful protest, but really domestic terror. My administration coordinated with the state and local authorities to very, very swiftly deploy the National Guard, surge federal law enforcement to Kenosha and stop the violence.
President Trump speaking during a trip to Kenosha, where he focused on maintaining law and order without mentioning the name of Jacob Blake once. In comparison, the approach from his Democratic Party rival Joe Biden was markedly different. During his visit to Kenosha, Mr. Biden accused President Trump of legitimizing the dark side of human nature.
We're in a situation now where we cannot let up. We cannot let up. Violence in any form is wrong. The idea that this president continues to try to divide us, give succor to the white supremacist, talks about how there's really good people on both sides, talks in ways that are just absolutely, I've never used this regard to president before, not only incorrect but immoral.
Well, according to a new poll by Ipsos, while most Americans support the demand for racial justice, their views are taking an increasingly partisan line, with many saying they're concerned about the breakdown of law and order. Maisha Cherry is assistant professor of philosophy at the University of California and author of the upcoming book, The Case for Rage. So what role does anger play in the current anti-racist struggle in the United States?
One of the things that I believe that anger is doing is that it's communicative. So it has kind of like a communicative value. And I think that even before a protester decides to go on the street, I think it can still be useful and constructive even before they go to a protest. So what do I mean by that? One of the things that anger does is that it expresses value, right? We can't be angry about anything that we don't value, right? If you're mistreated and I value you, then I'm going to respond to that mistreatment. And one of the apt responses to that mistreatment will be anger.
And that's about saying to other people, look, we really do care about this. It matters.
Right, right. But it's not just the people. It's also principles. So it's not only communicating that black folk truly do matter, but it's also communicating that justice matters. In some ways, what anger does, it has a tendency to motivate us to do something about that particular anger, which makes it very different from like fear. So usually what fear motivates us to do is to kind of retreat from the thing that is causing our fear. But what anger does, it motivates us to approach that thing, to want to do something to end that particular injustice. So just the fact that people are leaving their homes in the midst of COVID and the risks of getting an infection, anger does that. So it's useful in that particular sense.
Then it can go one of two ways, can't it? Because anger, and I know you've written about this specifically, it can either lead to a feeling of despair because you're angry but nothing seems to change, or if it's channeled in the right way, it can become a forward-looking thing that does bring about the kinds of results that people are presumably wanting to see happen here.
One of the things that I believe that what anger does is that I don't think, particularly this kind of anger, it doesn't lead to a kind of nihilism. They honestly believe that their voice will be heard, that things can change. Now, whether that's going to change today, whether racism is going to end tomorrow is not necessarily the case.
One of the issues that you point towards in making those observations is that if these kinds of protests, because people are angry, turn violent, not violence by everybody, of course, but violence by some people, the risk surely is that you alienate the very people who would otherwise be quite supportive of the cause.
So here's the thing that's complicated, particularly about the Black Lives Matter movement, is a decentralized movement. There's no Martin Luther King. There's no one leader that takes responsibility.
Do you think it needs? Do you think it needs that kind of figure to communicate more effectively to those who are supportive but doubtful about some of the things that have gone on?
I think a lot of people have learned about the benefits, but also what can go wrong when you have kind of a centralized kind of leadership. You think about the 60s, all of our leaders got assassinated and those movements kind of died down, right? So I think a lot of people have learned kind of how to organize in a very different way in which they won't be susceptible to those things that happened in the 60s. But here's the thing that I think that is one of the things that we have to remind ourselves of is that being that it's not a centralized kind of movement, you got to be aware that even when you look at these protests, there's a lot of people that can be at these protests that can have very different intentions. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they're all at the protests in order to fight against police violence. And we saw this in the 60s, even when you think about some of the massive resistance that took place with King, even he had what people would term infiltrators.
I suppose the point I'm getting at here is that doesn't there need to be an element of strategy about this in terms of how politically you will achieve that and who you need to have on board as you go about these protests? And if there seem to be too much violence and you lose the support of people as a result of that, that ultimately is counterproductive, isn't it?
A few years ago, when Black Lives Matter happened, it was very difficult for them to get kind of any kind of uptake, right? And so for lots of people, they thought, hey, Black Lives Matter movement, it went away, nothing really happened. And then you had the killing of George Floyd. And now you have corporate, you have the NBA, Black Lives Matter is on the court. You have all these athletes and also the organizations taking a stand. You now have all these businesses making these particular statements in the midst of what we are describing right here. So here's the question. Are they getting uptake? Is the violence really a distraction? I think there are some things that's happening in spite of the messiness of what's occurring. I think they are getting uptake. I think people are listening. I think people are getting the message and changing their ways and changing their particular policies.
There's a political context to this just now, of course, isn't there? And that's why I highlight the reactions that some people might have to what they see.
It's not going to turn everybody on. It's going to turn some people off. Martin Luther King turned people off. At his death, he was one of the most hated people in America. We have kind of changed this narrative about how Martin Luther King was so loved and everybody loved him. That was not the case. So no movement is going to get everybody on board.
Maisha Cherry, assistant professor of philosophy at the University of California, author of the upcoming book, The Case for Rage. Interesting, Isabel, to reflect on how anger can be used productively rather than destructively.
Well, indeed, it can be, as she says, a mobilizing force. But I think that what we're seeing in the United States at the moment is that the relatively minor episodes of violence are being exploited by Donald Trump, and the whole movement is a huge risk of being characterized by him as a violent movement, which it isn't. So there is a tremendous onus on the protesters, not only not to be violent themselves, but also to police episodes of violence from within the protest. And that, I think, if that doesn't happen, I think much of the goodwill will be lost. Because, you know, and everyone knows, violence is photogenic. That is what gets on the news, and that is what people who pay 30 seconds attention to the news will take away.
That point you made a moment ago, that's why I wondered, and Maisha Cherry said, no, I don't think we need this, whether some sort of dominant figure in charge might help.
Well, I guess it might help. I mean, we recently saw the funeral of John Lewis, who argued very consistently throughout his life for good trouble. It was, yes, make trouble, but don't make bad trouble. And I think that, you know, that is an absolutely essential message still.
Chris, what did you take from Maisha Cherry?
Well, it's an important issue, and it's been a catalyst for people to think about a lot of things. But relevant to coronavirus, the other element to this is that we've seen a disparity in who's succumbing to this. And it's an interesting disparity, because when we look in countries like the UK, you see a higher death toll in people who are from black and ethnic minority communities. So then everyone said, well, are we going to see the same thing happen across the African continent? A friend of mine is currently working in Nigeria with them to help combat COVID. They're not seeing the same trajectory in African countries that we are seeing in the West. And the question is why? And we think it might be a function of age.
Yes, you mentioned Africa being a young continent earlier, and that plays a part in your thinking when dealing with that specific question, does it?
Yeah, it does. And obviously what we don't know is where the world is going at the moment with all of the trajectory towards finding vaccines, getting back to normal. Because I think one of the most pertinent quotes in this whole thing was Melinda Gates from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And she said right at the beginning of all of this, if there's COVID anywhere, there is COVID everywhere. And the point she's getting at is that this is a global problem. We need a global solution. We have to all get together and solve this. It doesn't matter whether you're black or white. We need to solve this together, because until we can get a solution that works everywhere, then it is still everywhere. It's a bit like sweeping all the dirt out of your garden into the street. If the wind blows, it's going to blow it back into your garden. So it's no good just focusing on our own country. We've got to help every country have a solution to this in order to get the world back to its normal way of working.
My guests on Weekend Today, Isabel Hilton and Chris Smith. You'll hear plenty more from them over the next hour and a half. The latest international news is next, and we'll talk more about the coronavirus in the next hour as well, reflecting, among other things, on the latest figures coming out of India and the approach being taken to the virus in Hong Kong. This is Weekend from the BBC.